Good evening. Welcome to the Fall 2012 call-in series. This is our first research session, and we have a tremendous kickoff for the excellent set of research presentations for this fall. Last week we had our clinical discussion, and a very engaging one, which we'll be back for another segment in two more weeks. Before we get into the talk, I just want to mention a couple things on the NEA BPD webpage. There are now PowerPoint for presentations at the second International Borderline Personality Disorder Conference in Holland that was held recently. Those are beginning to appear and wanted to call your attention to that. The website providing access then to some of the most recent research presentations. There's also videos now from the 8th Annual NEA BPD Yale Conference that was held in May that are available there. And also there is same is available from the Diagnosing and Treating Adolescents with Borderline Personality Disorder Conference from March of this year that are available. And another new addition, recent addition, is the online e-course for professionals. But it's also available to anyone else. And having gone through it, it's very helpful and engaging. There's six 20-minute segments, and they cover making the diagnosis, suicidality, its course and outcome, treatment planning, treatment, psychopharmacology management, and family involvement. Mine of information, very clear and concise, but very helpful. And then next week for our research presentation, we will have Brian Palmer, one of our bright young psychiatrists that's just a delight to have in the borderline area, on general psychiatric management. And in two recent studies, this approach did essentially as well as dialectic behavior therapy and mentalization, and potentially is more readily adoptable and helpful. So this would be a very promising and hopeful thing to improve treatment access to people. And then 2 weeks from now, we'll have another session on connecting the dots, the clinical treatment discussion. And I want to mention there's prior audio recordings of those available, as there are of the other call-in sessions. And with that, there is a blog that you can comment on, and several people had, and we encourage you to do that. Now, all of this volunteer efforts are really important, but there are things that cost. So last but not least, as you use these resources and take advantage of the call in tonight, to consider its value to you and consider a donation to the NEA BPD. It's a 501c3 organization. And there's a place on the right-hand middle side of the web page to click, and then with your credit card or PayPal, you can make a donation to help cover the expenses that are just unavoidable. Okay, turning to our presentation, I want to mention if there's something that's not clear or you have questions that you'd like more information about on our presentation tonight, email your question to neabpd@aol.com, and we'll get it to Jenny McPhee, our speaker. If it's clarification during the session, if it's additional information, it'll be in our question and answer session afterwards. And if there's more questions than can be handled in the question and answer session, Dr. McPhee has very graciously agreed to provide written responses that would go on the website. Turning to Dr. McPhee, this is a real pleasure. She is one of our no longer junior researchers, but mid-career, very bright, wonderful assets with training at University of Rochester and developmental psychology, as clinical psychologist as well, has various awards and grants, including an NIMH small grant. And I must say that she has done more in that line of research on mothers and their borderline mothers and their child beyond the original scope of the grant application than most people have, and it's just very impressive and exciting. And I think we will hear a lot more from her. So let me stop at this point. I've taken enough time and turn it over to Dr. McPhee, who we're just delighted to have with us tonight to kick off the fall research sessions.
Well, thank you very much, Jim, for a very nice introduction. And thank you, NEA BPD, for putting this all together. I think it's absolutely wonderful and very exciting. And I want to thank you for the invitation, Jim, and also for the support and guidance you gave me when I was writing that NIMH grant back in 2005. You were very, very much appreciated, so thank you. Welcome to everybody listening. It's so wonderful to have so many other people interested in borderline personality disorder, and I think that the work that this organization is doing in encouraging research and encouraging clinical developments that will help people is just very, very exciting. We don't know as much as we would like to. Hopefully we will in the future know more, but a start has certainly been made. And specifically, I'm going to be talking tonight about mothers who have borderline personality disorder and their children's development. What do we know about that? Of course, one thing we know is that borderline personality disorder does affect people largely during their years of child rearing. And so it's particularly salient to be thinking about the effect on children. I'm going to start just by going over the overview. We're on slide 2 now. I'm going to just discuss child development in general, just to start with, give an overview. And then I'm going to discuss an interesting similarity conceptually between borderline personality disorder and these child development tasks. I'm going to suggest two questions that I think that similarity raises for us tonight. And then I'm going to suggest that we look at the development of children whose mothers have borderline personality disorder as a way to, in part, answer these two questions. Before I start out on what we do know about offspring, I'm going to do a short caveat about avoiding any kind of mother-bashing type of slant to any of this. But then I will review the research. We don't know a great deal, as I say, but we hopefully will know more in the future. But I will relay to you all what we do know. Bearing in mind, of course, that research doesn't always answer all the marvelous questions the things that you will want to know. We're fairly limited with our samples, the sizes, and the questions that we ask and the way that we do it. So, but I will let you know as much as we do know at this point. I will also then suggest that there is more that we do need to know, and I will be letting you guys know what I'm hoping to be able to do. And then I will end with talking about what kinds of interventions might be useful. Couple of terms before we start. In addition to diagnosing borderline personality disorder as a yes-no diagnosis, I'll also be referring to research that assesses borderline features along a continuum. And so that would be a self-report questionnaire that any individual could fill out, and everybody will be between very low and very high and somewhere in the middle, perhaps, on a continuous measure of borderline features. And the other term that might be useful is the word normative. We used to call our comparison groups that we would compare the group of interest to normal, but there really is no such thing as normal, and even scientists have cottoned on to that now. So we use the term normative, which refers to a range of normal. So it doesn't mean it's exactly normal. But the normative comparison groups that we'll be referring to, that we'll be comparing those children to the children of mothers who have borderline personality disorder, will be mothers who do not have borderline personality disorder. And I won't get into too many details about each study this time, but you could always look that up if you're interested. So going to slide number 3 now, that's the child development task slide. As I say, I'm going to just go over the beginning of what we know about development just in general now. And the first thing is that during the first year of an infant's life, one of the most salient domains of development in terms of the social and emotional development is the development of a secure attachment to one or more caregivers. If a child is fortunate enough to receive responsive and sensitive care, a child forms a secure attachment, which, just like it sounds, makes the child feel secure and loved and relaxed. And unfortunately, in many circumstances, the parent or the caregiver, whoever the caregiver is unable to be entirely responsive and entirely sensitive, at least not enough to help the child feel entirely secure. And so we also have a category of attachment in that first year called insecure. and that there are some children, furthermore, who have attachment difficulties altogether and have a very difficult time having any kind, either secure or insecure, attachment to their caregivers, and we term those disorganized. And I'll be saying a little bit more about that later. Second year, as you know, the demands of parenting change during the second year and the toddler period, as children develop a little bit of self-development, the beginnings of autonomy, and the child's likely to say no and no, I won't, and have a tantrum on the supermarket floor. And it makes parenting very much more challenging, perhaps, than the first year. And during the first year, you may lose a lot of sleep. But basically, being sensitive and responsive is all that's required in terms of social and emotional development, that is. But by the time you get to the toddler period, you also have to be setting limits and teaching the children social mores. So that requires a lot of additional skills and can be very challenging for parents. Then we move into the preschool period, and that's when children begin to learn to self-regulate. In the toddler period, they're not able to regulate their own emotions and behavior. Hence, you have to just sort of pick the child off the supermarket floor when they're having a tantrum, put them in the car, and take them home. But by the time they're in preschool, the kind of regulation that you've had to help them with is more internalized, so that children are able to regulate their own emotions and behavior quite well. And then by the time they go to school, from ages 6 to 12 approximately, they're developing more peer relationships and school functioning. And then interestingly, in adolescence, which is why I have been studying adolescence at the same time as I've been studying younger children, these early stages of attachment, self-development, and self-regulation are revisited. So that in terms of attachment, adolescents start venturing into romantic relationships. In terms of self-development, they are forming more of an identity in terms of their values and goals. And in terms of self-regulation, it is quite difficult for adolescents to manage their own emotions and impulsivity and other such behavior and emotional self-regulation. That's something I have to learn how to do again. Skipping up to from childhood to adults, we're able to assess adult attachment as well, using a clinical interview, and similar to the infants, we're also able to categorize individuals as secure or insecure. And I'm just going to give you a couple of categories that are subcategories of this, because they will come up in research we're going to discuss later. So a secure adult attachment in this interview is an individual who is able to discuss their childhood when asked, in terms that are coherent, and whether it was a difficult childhood or a relatively easy childhood, they're able to be coherent and able to talk about it calmly and fairly in a healthy kind of detached way. However, there's also a category that's called preoccupied, and these are individuals who, for very good reason, often because there has been abuse or some other difficult occurrence, are still preoccupied and angry, for example, with what has gone on in their childhood. And they need to talk about it at great length, and that is a lot of what the interview ends up being about. On the other hand, there are also individuals who are called dismissive. And dismissive individuals don't really want to talk about their childhood at all. And so they will say, I don't remember, it was fine, it was okay. You know, they just really don't want to go back there. They dismiss the whole thing. They don't want to talk about it. And then there's also a fourth category, which is called unresolved. And these individuals have experienced loss or abuse, and they are unresolved in their processing of the loss or the abuse. And they are categorized as being unresolved. So I will, again, talk about those later. I know it's a little bit of a mouthful, all of those terms all at once, but it is important. And finally, on this slide three, I just wanted to mention we're going to be talking about representations. And representations are the mental structures. I mean, they're not visible on an X-ray, but depending on one's early history and one's early experience, one develops a representation of what experience was like. So, for example, a child by the end of the first year might develop a representation of people as mostly being kind and responsive and there if you need them. And as they get a little bit older, that representation will not only include representations of what other people are generally expected to be like, but also what they feel about themselves. They feel loved, they feel worthy of care, and they feel relaxed, and the world is an easy place. And, of course, for representations for children who've had a more difficult time when they're young, they may feel the world is a little bit less trustworthy, and they may tend to be more aggressive, for example, or more withdrawn. And they may concomitantly feel about themselves that they are less worthy and of care and feel less good about themselves. What we are able to do with representational development is assess it in young children of preschool age using their storytelling, and I'll be discussing that in a little while. So we can code videotapes of children's storytelling and able to get a window on these children's representations. And that the adult attachment interview that I just mentioned with the secure, preoccupied, dismissive, and unresolved categories, that provides a window on adults' representations of their childhood. So we were able to compare those, and we will be talking about a study coming up that we can do that. Jim, am I talking too fast or anything? Would you like to be anything?
Everything's fine so far.
Okay. We're now on to slide number 4. So as I had just mentioned in slide number 3, the first three tasks of child development are attachment, self-development, self-regulation. And these three tasks are also revisited in adolescence. So what we had noticed, or I noticed, in reading the literature was that borderline personality disorder, too, has been conceptualized as a disorder of attachment with symptoms including fear of abandonment and volatile relationships. It's also been conceptualized as a disorder of self-development with symptoms including identity disturbance, dissociation, and emptiness. And thirdly, it's been conceptualized as a disorder of self-regulation with symptoms including impulsivity, inappropriate expressions of anger, self-harm, and suicidal behavior. In addition, at the level of representations, individuals who have borderline personality disorder tend to represent other people as more malevolent and unempathic than do other normative comparisons. So this led me to ask two questions. We're now on to slide 5. How well can mothers with borderline personality disorder support their children's development if perhaps they're struggling with similar issues? Now, it should be noted that these are just conceptual similarities that it was interesting to me to note. We don't have any proof that they are one-on-one the same. However, it is interesting to think that mothers who might be struggling with these issues themselves might have some difficulty in being able to parent their children through those very same stages or same issues. And the second question that's interesting to me is, perhaps is borderline personality disorder in part a disorder with its origins in early child development? Could it be that for some individuals who end up developing borderline personality disorder in adolescence or early adulthood have had difficulty with those domains way back when they were little children? Moving on to slide 6, at risk of the development of borderline personality disorder are children whose mothers have the disorder. And so study of these children whose mothers have the disorder may help answer these two questions. We know that offspring of women with BPD are at higher risk than the general population to develop psychopathology in general, including borderline personality disorder, firstly because there's a large genetic component to the disorder, and also with research whose methodology perhaps leaves a little bit desired. However, there is research on interviewing parents, or perhaps not even interviewing them, but interviewing relatives of those with borderline personality disorder, but just having the patients talk about their relatives. But anyway, it's not necessarily the best methodological research, but there's enough of it that suggests that relatives of those with borderline personality disorder are more likely to have the same disorder themselves. So if, as I have chosen to do, we study the children whose mothers have borderline personality disorder and compare them to offspring whose mothers do not, normative comparisons, that is, and if we were able to follow them up to adolescence or early adulthood, we might perhaps get a window on the development of borderline personality disorder and possible precursors. It should be noted, however, right at the outset, that this line of research that I'm involved in cannot disentangle genetic components from environmental components in the development of anything, because they're very much intertwined. All right, now we're on to slide 7, and this is the caveat about mother bashing. We're all ashamed in our discipline of psychology and also of psychiatry that we have an ignominious history, so that, for example, schizophrenic mothers, quote-unquote, were thought to cause schizophrenia in their children, and refrigerator mothers, quote-unquote, were thought to cause autism in their children. And even in a fairly recent review of the offspring of depressed mothers literature, the authors, which is where I got the term mother bashing from, said, you know, we have to be very careful not to blame the individual for any difficulties with parenting or with child development, but to blame the disorder. These disorders are hugely, hugely challenging for everybody concerned. And borderline personality disorder makes it extremely challenging to be a parent, but love for the child and motivation to be the best parent one can be is certainly not in doubt. So I just want to make that very, very clear at the outset, that it's the disorder that is our object of study and our object of possible intervention. But we're not in any way being critical of an individual or certainly their desire to be the best parent they possibly can be. So there may indeed be, and I will indeed be drawing attention to problems occurring in offspring, but I don't want in any way this to be interpreted as it's the mother's fault, quote-unquote. Moving on now to slide number 8, we're going to start now talking about what we know, and we'll go back and review the same tasks of early childhood that I had introduced the talk with. So starting with slide 8, we have what do we know, attachment. We do know that mothers with borderline personality disorder tend to be, not all of them of course, but it tend to be when comparing with normative comparisons, a little bit more insensitive and a little bit more intrusive when their infants are 2 months and 13 months old. And that in a separate study, when infants are 3 months old and comparing them with both normative comparisons and also children of depressed mothers, that mothers with borderline personality disorder have a hard time being positive in an emotional sense, being cheerful and upbeat with their children. And they have also a hard time with being as interactive as these other two groups of mothers are with their infants at 3 months. And then,
could you give an example of the insensitivity and intrusive?
Yes, this was not my research, so I think the best thing to do to suggest to people would be to go back into the articles that I've cited there and see exactly how they measured that. But it would be, for example, having difficulty noticing if a child is tired and keep shoving something at them and trying to push something at them, and it would be perhaps best to leave them alone at that moment, sort of being a little bit intrusive in an insensitive manner. But I was, as I say, not the person to do the research, so it would really require a close reading of those designs and exactly how they coded it and what they were looking for. And I wouldn't mind betting that in those articles you will get examples there. Sorry, not a very satisfactory answer, Jim. And then 80% of these children, infants at 13 months, are categorized in terms of their attachment as disorganized. So that means that they are having a hard time forming an attachment with their mothers, and this can be for two different reasons. It can either be because they're afraid of their mother, and so that when they decide that they're feeling distressed, for example, and they want to crawl to their mother for comfort, they feel like they're a little bit afraid of her at that moment, and so they may get caught between approach and avoidance. But it also may mean that an infant being very attuned in terms of emotions at a very young age notices that the mother herself is very afraid. And so that, too, disorganizes that infant because the infant looks at the mother and says, my goodness, she's as frightened as I am. I feel like I can't really go to her right now for when I'm feeling distressed because she looks so afraid herself. So those are two pathways that are possible pathways to developing a disorganized attachment at that age. And we do know that infants who have a disorganized attachment can go on to be resilient and do very well, but it's a bit of a struggle. It's a challenging start. And that by the time children are age 4 to 7, they are somewhat more likely to have been neglected than our children in normative comparison samples. And by neglect here, we mean things like perhaps being left in a situation where somebody was not necessarily taking care of them as adequately as they might have been, some situation where they perhaps weren't getting entirely all the care that they needed for that time. But neglected children also can do quite well and can be very resilient. So this is not in any way mean that children are not going to go on and do okay. Any more questions about attachment? Good question, by the way, about the research, to go back and look actually at what is meant by those studies.
No, this is fantastic.
All right. Thank you, Jim. You're a sweetheart. Slide number 9. What do we know self-development? The answer in toddler period, the answer is nothing, not until I do a longitudinal study, which I hope to do. We have no research on toddler offspring of women with a borderline personality disorder. And self-development, however, will be addressed again when we get to adolescence in terms of identity. Now we're moving to slide number 10, which is what do we know, self-regulation in young children. In terms of temperament, this is one of our studies, offspring age 4 to 7 are reported to be more fearful, more easily frustrated, and having less effortful control than do normative comparisons. And these particular temperamental qualities are interesting because they parallel perhaps their mothers also having temperament with some perhaps more fear and more easily feeling frustrated and less effortful control. What we mean by effortful control, which is quite a mouthful, is having difficulty controlling impulses. So that if, for example, there's a situation in which you really would like to behave in a certain way, because that's how you're taught you're supposed to behave, if you're a child, that is, a 4 to 7, but you're not able to control your impulses, then you would come out as being having less effortful control. So it's related to impulsivity and difficulties with controlling impulsivity. And then another study of ours, we have behavior problems in offspring age 4 to 7, in which we find that children are more emotionally reactive, more withdrawn, and more emotional and anxiety disorders, and also ADHD than do normative comparisons. Interestingly, we did not find in our sample that children had more externalizing problems like being aggressive or oppositional and those kinds of disorders. But they did have a few more problems with their emotions, including anxiety and being withdrawn and ADHD than did comparisons. Now moving to slide 11, I'm going to move to self-regulation. I'm skipping all the way now from young children to adolescents. And this first sample is a psychiatric sample, which means that they take children in a wide age range. As developmentalists, we like to keep children in relatively close to a particular period. But these were children age 4 to 18, so I guess they're combining both age groups. They found the children had more impulse control disorders than normative comparisons. And then the second study, offspring of women with BPD aged 11 to 18, had a more emotional and behavior problems than did normative and clinical comparison groups. And then in one of our studies, we found that offspring aged 14 to 17 tended to be more aggressive. And this included relational aggression and verbal aggression. And they also tended to self-harm more, which you can conceptualize self-harm in part as being aggression against the self. And so these offspring, yes.
Could you give an example of the relational aggression?
Yes, certainly. Relational aggression means that it's not the kind of aggression where you actually go over and biff somebody over the head and hit them or do anything to hurt somebody physically, but you may do something to hurt somebody emotionally. So relational aggression would be getting together with some of your buddies and ganging up on somebody and agreeing to exclude them or bullying them or in other way hurting them in social relationships. But it's relational rather than actually being a physical attack. Is that clear, do you think, Jim?
Yes.
Okay, thank you for the clarification. That was a very good question. And finally, in one of our studies, we have offspring age 14 to 17 experience more stress. They relate that they are experiencing more stress. And interestingly, the stress that they relate experiencing correlates with their own borderline features. So we've actually assessed borderline features in these adolescents. And that mother's borderline features correlates with their adolescent's borderline features. And this could raise all kinds of suppositions about how similar the adolescents are to their mothers, if they're both sharing some borderline features. But it should be remembered that all the studies that I've done to date, or we've done, are cross-sectional. So it's just an association at this point. We cannot infer that there is any causality, that the mother's symptoms are leading to the adolescent's symptoms or anything like that. But it is interesting that they are related to one another. Moving now to slide number 12, which is what do we know in representations. I'm moving to representational development now, and we're back with young children. I had mentioned that we assessed representations in young children by looking at their narratives, their storytelling. And what we do, if you can imagine a little tiny table about 2.5 feet square, very close to the floor, which you place a very tiny little chair, And then you have an adult in a slightly larger chair sitting opposite the child. And on the table you have all kinds of props that you might find in a family, like little couches and stoves and things that are needed to tell the story. And you also have figures of the family members, the mothers, the fathers, other children, two children usually, in the stories. And what the examiner will do, sitting on the big chair, is move the props around as though in a play and tell the beginning of a little story. And this story will set up something that's happening in the family that is a challenging family situation. So it might be, for example, that the child has spilled his or her juice, and the parent will end up by saying, "Susan, you spilled your juice," in an angry tone. And then the examiner will turn to the little person, age 4 to 7, and say, "So tell me, what happens now?" And the child will continue to move the props and the dolls around and tell a story about what happens after the beginning of the story and finish the story. We're able to videotape these stories, and then we're able to code them for things that we're interested in. And I do have a paper on this, and so I'm certainly welcome to let you have that if you would like. The copyright for the journal means that I can't have it actually posted on my website, but there's an email address. You can email me, and I will send it along. Anyway, what we found, and again, you can see that my same theme here is I'm very interested in BPD and attachment, self-development, and self-regulation. I looked at themes in these children's stories that I thought were related to their attachment and found that the individual's children whose mothers had BPD told stories in which there were more negative parent-child relationship expectations, there was more role reversal in which the children took care of the parents, and there was more fear of abandonment in their stories than for normative comparisons. And that in terms of self-development, I chose inconsistent children or incongruent when the same child is portrayed in the story as doing completely opposite things. And also shame. I was interested in shame as a representation of self because that's also related to BPD. And we found that the children whose mothers had BPD were more incongruent and there were also more shameful representations. And in terms of self-regulation, the children whose mothers had BPD were less coherent in telling their stories, and they also had more intrusion of traumatic themes that came in a very strange and awkward fashion into the stories. And the study ends with just a question: could these possibly be precursors to BPD for some children in some certain situations? Moving to slide number 13, what do we know about mothers and children's representations? Mothers are more likely to be preoccupied and unresolved on their adult attachment interviews. And you remember right at the beginning we talked about preoccupied as being, for example, very angry still about their childhood and needing to talk at great length about all the horrible and difficult and challenging things that had happened. And remember we talked about unresolved as having experienced loss or abuse, and being unresolved with the process of grieving to completion those experiences. And we found that mothers, which others have found before, many people have found before, that mothers with borderline personalities are more likely to be preoccupied and also unresolved in their adult attachment rather than dismissive. And you remember, dismissive is when you don't want to talk about it. Now, what we did in our study is we looked at the preoccupied unresolved, and we found that it was correlated with children's narrative representations of attachment in terms of their fear of abandonment and their role reversal, self, incongruent child, and confusion between fantasy and reality, which is a part of dissociation. And it was correlated with self-regulation, destruction of objects. So we decided that children destroying objects in their stories would be an example of self-regulation or difficulty with self-regulation. So we found that the mother's attachment was related to the representations, is correlated with the children's attachment regulations. And furthermore, we found that again, in a cross-sectional study, so no causation can be inferred from this, but we found that their parenting was the mediating factor between their own mother's parenting was between their own preoccupied, unresolved attachment representations and their children's fear of abandonment. Which suggests, but of course we'd have to do longitudinal studies to find out for sure, that through the mother's parenting, which is influenced by her own preoccupied and unresolved representations, she may lead the child to have his or her own representations of a fear of abandonment, which we see in their stories. and perhaps this also is a pathway to borderline personality disorder for some children. Number 14, what do we know in adolescence? We're moving back now to identity development, self-development, but in larger...
Could I interrupt for just a second?
Yes.
And using different words, could you explain the mediation part between the mother's parenting mediating between preoccupied, unresolved? That's her preoccupied, unresolved, and the children's fear of abandonment?
Yes. Well, as I say, what one would like to be able to do is, if it was a longitudinal study that I had done, what one would like to be able to say is that before the child was born and also once the child was born, this mother, because of her own illness, is more likely to be preoccupied and unresolved with respect to her own attachment, and that this would in turn affect her parenting, how able she is to be sensitive, how able she is to not be hostile towards a child, for example, how able she is to support the child's autonomy, so that her representations are affecting her ability to parent, because that's what her understanding of parenting is. It's in part how she was parented back as a child, so that her representations affect her parenting, and that parenting then leads the child to develop a fear of abandonment, which we then see in that child's stories. Now, the difficulty, what I've just said, is that we did not have longitudinal data. We did not follow these children from birth to age 7 years old. And so we can only say that these three things were associated with age with other, and that in terms of statistical analysis, it looks like this would be a possibility. But we can't show it for sure this way. Is that better?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you for the question. So, at adolescence, we looked at adolescents in our lab in terms of their identity development, and we find that mothers with borderline personality disorder show less support for their autonomy for their adolescence. It's difficult for them to support their adolescents sometimes going out on their own and being separate from them. And they also have difficulty with closeness with their teens. In terms of what we actually see in the adolescents, for the most part, these adolescents look resilient, and on most of these measures of identity development, they looked fairly good. There was only one that did not look so good, which was that these teenagers were more likely to recant, which means to change their mind, to placate their mothers, apparently to placate their mothers. And what we did, and I wish I could show you a movie, but I'm not able to put it up online because I don't have permission from mothers to do that, but I could have showed you if it was just a one-time thing. We set them up having a discussion about things they argue about at home, the mother and the adolescent in a room with a camera running. And then we go back and code the mothers and the adolescents and their relationship for these things that we're interested in. So identity development seems to be slightly difficult for the mothers to support with autonomy and closeness with their teens for some of them. And the kids, the adolescents, having a little bit of a difficulty holding to their own opinions. If their mother disagrees with them, they're more likely to change their mind to make their mothers feel better. And in terms of their attachment, now it's romantic attachment, we find that the offspring, age 14 to 17, themselves are more likely to be preoccupied and fearful with their romantic attachment than normative comparisons. Moving along to slide number 15, what more do we really need to know about this? What we really need to know is the processes that underlie this atypical development for some offspring from age 12 months to 5 years. And in addition to the kinds of things that I have looked at so far, which include representational development and the relationship and attachment and behavior, I would also, and it would be very important to look at the level of physiology, especially stress regulation in young children as they're growing up. How are they learning to cope with stress? You remember that one of our studies found that the mother's stress was associated with the adolescent stress. So everybody's feeling very stressed. How are their systems for regulating stress developing as young children? Because that's something where we could intervene if we wanted to. So you need to know more about processes underlying this development from 12 months to age 5 years, the level of physiology, behavior, representations in a longitudinal study. That's the only way we could go and unpack that mediational model that I just explained to you that we found. Does parenting indeed come follow a mother's difficulty with her own preoccupied and unresolved attachment? And does the parenting then in turn indeed lead longitudinally to a child's fear of abandonment demonstrated in their storytelling? But we would need the longitudinal study to do that. Then, furthermore, it would be important, if at all possible, to follow these children on from 5 years to early adolescence or early adulthood to see which ones do or do not develop borderline personality disorder, or at least what level of borderline features on a continuum they develop, depending on what kind of development they have had earlier. The challenges, and I realize these are a little technical, but the challenges for me are to do this are choice of comparison groups and recruitment issues. However, I do think that it's an important study to be done, and I'm working currently on a grant to try and persuade somebody to help me do this. But I do think that it will happen, whether it's me doing it or somebody else. It's the next thing that needs to be done in this area. And finally, what I would like to talk about, I'm sure all of you know a great deal about interventions that can help, and I just want to point up that there are three types of interventions that come to mind readily, I think, for helping children in these situations. And there are interventions, actually, that would also help mothers who have borderline personality disorder with their own distress. The first is a child-parent psychotherapy. And we call it dyadic because what that means is that both the mother and the child are in the therapy room together with the therapist, working together with a therapist. And what they do is the therapist is trying to work with the child, work with the parent, work with their relationship, try and work with the parent's history and see how the parent's difficult history in some instances may be affecting how the parent sees that child. And so perhaps changing some of those perceptions so that the parent can see the child more as he or she is and not so much through the lens of their own experience as children. And we do have empirical evidence that this child-parent psychotherapy has increased attachment security and also changed narrative representations. There are two studies, one with maltreated children and one with children of depressed mothers, that suggest this. So given that attachment is a difficult area for individuals who have borderline personality disorder to establish a secure attachment with their infants, to be able to intervene to increase attachment security and to change these narrative representations, which currently are looking not so great, would also be very, very helpful, I think, in this population. Second one would be, Jim had mentioned earlier, mentalization-type therapy. And that is to improve the mother's understanding of herself and others in terms of her feelings, other people's feelings, her motivations, other people's motivations, her beliefs, other people's beliefs. And to work to improve that might not only help the mother with her own symptoms, and there has been not a great deal of research, but only from one group, as far as I know, but it does suggest that the treatment is effective and that it also remains effective after a long-term follow-up. But it was done in England under a very different healthcare system than we have here, so it would be a little difficult to replicate. However, it does suggest that this kind of therapy of helping the mother to understand herself and other people would be useful. Also because, and this was done in the United States, I believe, although now I just said that maybe it was also in England. But anyway, it's something that translates a lot easier, is that we have found that secure attachment is predicted by a mother's understanding of herself and others, by her level of mentalization. And we already know that a secure attachment is a very good thing to try and encourage in mothers who have this disorder. So mentalization therapy also might help with this whole process of helping mothers to be able to parent their children in helpful ways. And last but absolutely positively not least, is to foster secure attachment with other caregivers, and that family is very, very, very important in this area, that it does not have to be just one caregiver who provides absolutely everything a child needs. If any of the caregivers are suffering from any particular disorder, there's a lot of stress around them and a lot of difficulty and challenges financially and so forth, other caregivers or other family members, grandparents, aunts and uncles, even friends and other people can foster a secure attachment with that child and also support the child not just in infancy but through childhood, and that can make a huge, huge difference to a child's resilient outcomes, which is what we're all hoping for. And finally, before we just go to our discussion sections, I would very much like to acknowledge with huge gratitude the grant from National Institute of Mental Health that helped me do all the research with the younger children that I mentioned today, the children from age 4 to 7. and that I would also like to acknowledge the University of Tennessee for funding me, and it was that money that I used to do the research with the adolescent population. And then I would also like to acknowledge Dante Cicchetti, who was my advisor at graduate school at University of Rochester. He's now at the University of Minnesota, and he gave me a very, very strong foundation in developmental psychopathology, working with maltreated children. And all I had to do was come up with a new population to use all the things he had already taught me. And that's when I thought of how very much I wanted to study the children of mothers who have borderline personality disorder. I again would like to acknowledge Jim Brayling for his support and guidance. I don't know, I'm sure he probably does know by now, how incredibly valuable his support and guidance are to us newcomers when we were starting out in this field, how insecure we all feel, and how very helpful he was, and how very much he will be missed at NIMH right now. And I would like to thank the graduate and undergraduate students without whom all of this data collection would not have been possible. And this is actually quite a difficult data collection, involves a great deal of small pieces. And finally, last but very much not least, I would like to thank the mothers and their children and their adolescents who participated in these studies and gave so freely of themselves to help us in our understanding so that we can go ahead and design preventive interventions, hopefully, that can mitigate the effects of this very difficult disorder. So with that, I will stop, and I would welcome questions or anything else, clarifications or anything else anybody would like to share.
Yes, we've got a bunch. Thank you so much. Wow. I had enjoyed going over the PowerPoint, and your presentation is really super, and thank you also for timing things, just right on the dot. I'll try to group the questions, but one thing I want to mention before that is for our listeners, I think you can gather from all this the impact of what you can get from a small grant when people are starting out on a research career and the potential it can have for helping to seed and get going a program of important research. And parents for borderline personality disorder have kind of run with this ball and have raised the funds so that the Brain and Behavior Research Foundation, used to be NARSED, grants now this year has awarded two grants for borderline personality research to two junior investigators of some promise, and one will be presenting this fall on November 4th at Shelby, and another will be Dr. Rake, a psychiatrist, and the winner series will be presenting on their research. So it's helping to get new junior people in to do the work that we so badly need. I'm going to try to put these questions together to group them a little bit. One thing is a little bit of a clarification. It's two parts, really. Your mothers were all diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. Is that true?
That is correct.
Okay. Do you have a sense of how they compare? Are they more challenging than, say, a mother with alcoholism or with just soul depression or PTSD?
That's a very good question, and thank you, all of you who asked that question. In terms of working on a research project, I didn't have a single instance of any difficulty with any mother at all in this study, absolutely not at all. I think that when people are working clinically with individuals who have borderline personality disorder, difficulties that may come up over time that are not as often shared perhaps with those other groups that you mentioned, although there's a great deal of overlap between all of those groups and not distinct particularly entirely, is that individuals sometimes who have borderline personality disorder, and of course is only one symptom out of many, tend to have difficulty with anger, and I think it's termed inappropriate expressions of anger or whatever, and that can be more challenging than those other disorders you mentioned. But because the disorders are very interrelated and very overlapping, there's not a unique, difficult character. I've certainly had very difficult people as a clinician of many different kinds of disorders. Does that help a little bit?
Yeah, and I want to mention for our people, we've got a whole flock of questions here, and I'm trying as quickly and best I can to pull them together. So I hope for our questioners that are on the phone and listening in and sending these questions, if my trying to rearticulate and pull questions together has not really addressed, results in Dr. McPhee being able to address your question as well as you would like, would you resend it so we can pass it on to her to respond to after the session, since our time is going to be limited? We've got a lot of really good questions, and so it's going to be a challenge to get them here. So I do want everybody to have a chance. You're not being ignored. I'm just trying to group these in a way that will be helpful and cover as much as we can, but feel free. What about fathers in this was a question.
That's an excellent question. What we found in the sample that we were collecting was that it tended to be, we were recruiting from local hospitals, local outpatient clinics. It tended to be a sample in which most families were not living, the children were not living with a biological father. There were some, there was a proportion that were, but because the sample sizes are fairly small, that's too small of a proportion to be able to do much with just looking at the fathers alone. But a lot of the individuals with borderline personalities were either separated from the father or by this time with somebody else. So although it would be extremely important and interesting to find out more about fathers, they vary so much in how much time they've spent with the children and whether they're still living in the same household or not. To find a sample that's large enough of mothers and fathers living together and bringing up the children continuously would be quite challenging at that point. But that doesn't negate the fact of how important it would be to do some research on that. It just means it's difficult.
What about the intersection with social services, given the mother's disorder that some of the children might be placed in foster care for neglect or emotional problems with the child?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In terms of my research, if they had not been with the child, if the child was in foster care, we didn't study them, we didn't include them. But certainly that is something that can happen. We have a great deal of data from the Department of Children's Services in Nashville and Tennessee on issues of being placed in foster care. So that was something that we will be able to look at when we get to it.
Okay, super. I wanted to mention, you know, some of the questions get into almost legal intersection, a few here, and I'm going to avoid those because we don't want to get drawn into without really knowing the details on that. What about this relationship between attachment security in the first year of life and adult attachment style? Do you see interventions that can be put in place to alter the course during that time interval?
Yes, what we do know from research, and this is not my research, but many, many people have shown that if you are able to assess with the clinical interview I'm talking about now, not a questionnaire, but a clinical interview, the adult attachment of a mother before her child is born, that her category of attachment, whether it's preoccupied, unresolved, dismissive, or secure, predicts her relationship with her child once the child is born and once the child is 12 months old in terms of the child's attachment, whether it's secure, insecure, disorganized, or whatever. So there's a very strong relationship between the mother's representation of attachment and her attachment with her infant once the infant's born and once the infant's 12 months old. Sorry, what was the second part of the question? I've lost my train of thought.
Just about what interventions?
Interventions, yes. That last intervention that I talked about, the parent-infant or parent-child, it can be children up to preschool age, psychotherapy, has been shown to improve security in the relationship between the mother and the child. And so we do have the type of intervention that might work, at least with children of that age, of young age. Older, we'll have to think about something that's slightly different. But for children from infancy through, say, preschool, we do have the dyadic therapy that has been shown to work with both maltreated children and also with children of depressed mothers.
Okay. I'm going to skip that because your work, what happens if they're adopted, is really going beyond that. The symptoms vary Did any of these children meet borderline personality disorder criteria if one was to apply that to pre-18? That it would seem like they really had the disorder full blown? Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a very good question, and that was obviously something that's very interesting to me and something I would like to do. What I had done initially with the adolescents was to do a pilot study before I did the study for real, in which I tried to do a clinical interview to assess borderline personality disorder along the lines of a diagnostic interview. And the teenagers just looked at me like, which planet did I just fly in from, asking these questions about whether their relationships had extreme ups and downs or not, and they just didn't relate to the questions. And so I decided that I was going to use a self-report measure of borderline features, which they were more comfortable filling out, rather than going for a diagnosis. So I didn't actually assess that.
Okay. A lot of borderline children, one comment is, seem to a lot of children of borderline parents, one person observed, seem to wind up in foster care. And what are the implications for the foster parents in terms of trying to provide family-mediated intervention to improve the prospects for the children?
Mm-hmm. That's a very good question. And just to touch back to these representations of unresolved loss and also unresolved abuse that the parents have, loss is definitely big in terms of developing a fear of abandonment, and that we do have these children now who are demonstrating a fear of abandonment, and that, of course, contributing to that for some of these children could be being placed in foster care. Mary Dozier has done some splendid research, not in this sample of children, but just in general, with all of the things that can be done with children in foster care to improve attachment. And she has done, I think, the most remarkable research to show not only is it possible with fairly simple interventions to improve security of attachment with young foster care children, but not only at the level of behavior of we observe attachment, but also at the level of their stress reactivity and their cortisol. They are able to regulate their stress much better after an intervention for foster children. So I think that I would refer the listeners who are interested in that to Mary Dozier, Dozier, and her work with foster children.
Super. If we can put a link to that on the website, I think that would be very, very helpful. It's to the point now, we've got many more questions. We'll try to group these and pass them on. And again, for our listeners, apologize we couldn't get to everything. And if your question still is hanging out there in terms of an answer, please resend it so we can pass it on to Dr. McPhee for the post-call and follow-up. But do bear in mind, some of the questions that I rephrased or skipped over dealt with individual clinical legal issues, and it would be inappropriate to get into that not knowing the full context and trying to deal with that briefly by phone. So you have to really stay on a more general level. So at 9:59, I want to thank you so much, Jenny. I knew this would be a great kickoff for the call-in series on the research, has been absolutely spectacular. Beyond five stars. Well, we just got to light up have five stars and light them up.
Could everybody see how great Jim was at his job at National Institute of Mental Health, encouraging all us new people? And I'm just sorry I can't see all of you, and I just want to thank all of you out there for attending this, and I would love to be in touch with these questions and try and answer them as best as I can. We don't know as much as we would like to, but I'm going to continue on in this area, and I'm very grateful for all your support.
Jenny, thank you so much. It's Perry Hoffman. And, yes, hats off to Jim Breeling, who has started so many careers that now have flourished. So it was a nice kickoff for our research to have both of you together tonight. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you. How many people did we have tonight?
I don't know.
Hello?
Hello. I don't know, but it's... we'll try to get back to you on that. And thank you, everybody, for calling in, and have a great week, and hope you can join us next Sunday at 8 o'clock for Brian Palmer's talk on general psychiatric management. Have a great evening and week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.